We gonna fight over the check again? No, because you're gonna let me pay. Only if we go someplace nice. He smiled under his mustache. That was my plan. The lawyer says the Arabs will sell my house back. Really? I nodded. A bunch of other bullshit has to happen before I can move back in, though.
With the county?
Yep.
Still, it's progress.
That's what I keep telling myself.
Then we should celebrate.
He leaned forward and kissed me. His mustache tickled and he tasted like one of those eucalyptus lozenges, though I didn't think he had a sore throat or cold. I hoped I didn't taste like somebody's ash can. He stood and asked if 7:30 was okay, and I said I'd be ready. Should I dress up? He nodded and smiled, and I watched him walk out to the Motor Lodge parking lot, get into his Toyota station wagon, and drive off. I wondered what he'd tell his wife about tonight, about where he was going and who with, and I wondered again what I thought I was doing, having been with a married man only once before, back in Saugus, Massachusetts, for one night when I was still using. He was a bar customer, a salesman who dressed in custom-tailored suits, silk ties, and even gold cufflinks. We all thought he overdid the wardrobe, but one night Jimmy Doran let him stay after hours while we cleaned up, and soon four or five of us were doing lines and drinking and moving to the sound system. After a while, the salesman was making moves on me, and the enemy voice in my head was a cooing dove.
Already Nadira is dressed and in the kitchen area slicing eggplant for one of the many dishes she will prepare for tomorrow evening's dinner party. But it is only Friday morning, no later than 8 o'clock, and I sit at the counter with hot tea and toast. Nadijun, do you not think you will be able to cook one meal in one day?
Akbar sar Masood!
Dust on your head, she to me says. And she smiles as she turns to rinse her hands in the sink's water. Before her, the kitchen window is only partially blocked by the staircase to the new widow's walk, something I was grateful to see, for Nadi has said nothing of it. The Najars completed their work yesterday, not long after the lunch hour. I was so pleased with the final appearance of it, the long straight rails of the staircase, the strong wide boards of the walk, the railing thereto, that when I wrote the young Najar his final check, I included a $50 bonus for such a professional job well done. I was, of course, still feeling the beneficial effects of the visit I had made to a lawyer in downtown Corona that afternoon, a very short gentleman wearing a silk bow tie who, for $150, heard the details of my situation, examined the paperwork of the sale from the county, and then advised me there was nothing anyone could do against me. The property belonged to me now, and I could do with it what I wish. Last evening, Nadi, Ismail, and I stood on the new structure and watched the sun disappear. It was a ball of bright saffron sinking into the sea, turning the water purple, the sky orange and green. Nadi put her arm around our son's waist, and she began to tell him of the beauty of the Caspian. Did he remember any of it? But, for the first time, there was very little evidence of pain in her voice when she spoke of our old life, and I put my hand upon her shoulder and listened to her speak to our son. And as the sky and ocean color slowly darkened, I felt a certain regret that I must sell this property that has brought my Nadi back to herself. But I felt also all the more determined to make it worth my troubles, to earn back at least 3 times my original investment. For 2 days I have heard nothing from the woman lawyer in San Francisco, nor have I heard from the county tax office. And this is as it should be. I will not contact them. They have heard my offer, and if they refuse it, I can turn to the open market. Yesterday, I received 2 telephone inquiries regarding the home, and I have made appointments for showings on Monday. I rise from my breakfast and go to the door for my shoes. I see that Nadi has hung something new on the wall above the sofa. In a gold frame, it is the prized photograph of myself and General Purat addressing Shahanshah at a Persian New Year celebration at the Imperial Palace. The king is dressed in the finest of European suits, while Purat and I are in full uniform, our hats in our hands, smiling at something complimentary the king has said of our Air Force. Also in the photo are 3 men, a foreign minister from Africa, and two large savakis, their hands folded before them, their faces and eyes empty of all humor. I know Nadi has hung this picture not only for Soraya's benefit, but for her own as well, for of course Soraya's new relatives have already seen the photograph in our expensive apartment in Berkeley. They have investigated us, and they know the caliber of people we are. But I suppose Nadi must remind them, so they do not regard this small bungalow and perhaps forget. My wife rinses radishes and cucumbers in the sink for a meal we will not eat until tomorrow evening. I wish to tell her to slow herself, to rest. Our daughter is already married, and we must no longer break our backs. But I know my Nadi. My lack of concern will worry her further, and then she will insist we paint the walls and hang new drapes before tomorrow. No, for this moment I leave her to herself. I will drive down the hill into Corona and purchase tasteful outdoor furniture for our widow's walk, and perhaps I can find what is called a love seat for the young husband and wife. My lovely daughter, who I last saw 2 weeks past, stepping into the rear of a limousine dressed in ivory satin, her long black hair tucked up upon her head beneath a spray of baby breath flowers, which she wore like a crown.
In only 2 nights and 2 mornings, Lester Burden went from being a distraction for me to the main movie, and I wasn't even sure how that happened, though I know it started when he picked me up right at 7:30 Wednesday night wearing polished black cowboy boots, black pants, a gray tweed jacket, and a white shirt buttoned at the throat. His hair was combed straight back, and his mustache looked less crooked. He was so handsome, I immediately doubted how I looked. I'd changed only twice, finally ending up in black rayon slacks, a white dress blouse, and a short rust jacket I always liked because when I buttoned the bottom, it pulled into my waist and made me look like I had more of a bust. I wore my black dress pumps, and the pressure of the right one felt almost good, like a fresh bandage. I had put my hair up, too, and now I wondered if I looked womanly enough. But Les took me in like he'd never seen anything so perfect before, and on the drive up the highway for San Francisco under the setting sun, I wondered if he left his house dressed like that. What did he tell his wife? The Orion Room was at the top of the Hyatt Regency, close to the long wharfs of Embarcadero Street. The restaurant took up the whole top floor and was surrounded by carpet-to-ceiling windows that leaned out at a slight angle. A large square bar was in the middle of the room, and 3 bartenders were working back there now, their shirts and ties and faces bottom-lit with green light. The bar was full of well-dressed men and women laughing and talking over the music of the piano player, who sat on a raised platform, a dim light on him as he played and sang an old song I couldn't name. The maitre d' led us past crowded candlelit tables, and I tried not to limp as much as my foot still needed, which was hard to do in heels, and I was sure everybody must be looking. Our table was small, covered in white linen, and it was right up against one of the glass walls. I could see the tops of skyscrapers looking gold and pink in the dusk light, the blue stretch of the bay, but the whole picture was moving, and I had to sit down in the chair the host pulled out for me. "It's a revolving room," Lester said. "Would you rather go someplace else?" I looked at him, then back at the window. He was right. Already I was seeing less of the tall office buildings and more of San Francisco Bay. A half dozen tiny white sails, the yellow hills of Berkeley on the other side. I laughed. "This is weird." "Do you like it?" Lester was smiling, though his eyes were in a squint like there was only one answer he could really handle. "Yeah, I like it, and I did once I got used to it." Our waiter showed up fast, his blonde hair so short he could have been in the military. He asked what we'd like to drink, and when I ordered a mineral water, Les did the same. After the waiter left, I lit up a cigarette. "You don't have to go without because of me, Lester." "Oh, I don't miss it. I'm not a big drinker anyway." "Me neither. I mean, I wasn't." "You weren't?" "Only when I did lines. That's what almost killed me." Lester's brown eyes looked more deep-set than ever. "You've done them too, haven't you, Officer Burden?" Les shook his head. "Afraid not." The young waiter came with our mineral waters. He handed us tall menus, then recited the night's specials. I watched him walk back to the main dining area, Then I looked over all the full candlelit tables to the piano player who wasn't singing now, just playing something slow and sad, and I turned and looked back out the window. This time I could see the Bay Bridge to Oakland, the long gray cables in the twilight. Have you ever done anything against the law, Lester? That's a strange question. I blew smoke at the glass. A conversation starter. We've already slept together, and I don't even know your middle name. Victor. Lester Victor? Not very musical, is it? No, it isn't. I sipped my mineral water. Well? Recently or a long time ago? How recently? He glanced down at the tablecloth. The restaurant was turning to the east now, our windows facing out over South San Francisco, so Lester's face was shadowed. It's pretty big. How big? Big enough not another soul knows about it. Can you handle that? You mean, can you trust me? I already trust you, Kathy. Do you want it in your lap? Do I have to keep it there? Lester smiled. I guess not. He looked once around the restaurant, then leaned forward and said in a low voice, I planted evidence. You did? He nodded slowly, like he was trying to see how I felt about this. Not our school teacher boy in blue. I felt an almost electrical current in my arms and face. Lester smiled again, a little sadly, though. Well? There was this guy out near the reservoir, this little runt who used to beat up his wife like it was a pastime. He was an engineer or something, a teetotaler, but he'd go off the deep end and take a belt or a piece of garden hose to her. We never found out what exactly. The neighbors would call us, and my partner and I would show up on a hot night, talk ourselves in, and there'd be these bloody welts on our arms and legs, but they'd both stand there together, sometimes arm in arm, like it was nobody's business. I'd take her off to the side and ask if she was staying quiet out of fear of him, but she just looked at me with these big, wet eyes, like she didn't know what I was talking about. This was before the domestic violence law, Kathy, when we couldn't bring the batterer in unless the victim filed a complaint. You think she liked it? My partner thought so. I didn't. Anyway, at least once a week, we'd get called out there, and after a while, I couldn't stand the sight of them, especially him. Bastard had the longest, skinniest neck you ever saw. I let out a laugh, and Lester did too. We had something on him, though. He had a prior conviction for possession of your old habit, and I didn't agree with my partner. I thought she was scared to death. So on one of those hot, tedious nights, I excused myself to go to the John, where I stuffed 2 8-balls in their closet behind a stack of towels. No way! I felt a tickle rise in my throat. He raised a finger to his lips. My ex-partner doesn't even know about this. Where'd you get it? A recovered Lincoln the day before. So what happened? We didn't have a warrant, so when I got home that night, I put in an anonymous call to the department, then slept like a baby. They both got picked up, but because of his prior, he got some time. A few months later, I drove by the house to check on her, but the new resident said she'd moved. He shook his head. She was scared to death of him. Shit, Lester. You just do what you want to do, don't you? I slipped my shoes off under the table. My right sole pulsed, but didn't hurt much. He smiled carefully and sipped his mineral water. But what if you were wrong? What if she did like it? He sat back a little, cocking his head at me. You really believe that? Maybe. Would you like that? His voice was sincere, naked, and it was hard not to play with him a bit. No, but I've known some real sickos. But how much better are they going to get if we allow them to live like that? There was that tightness in his face again, and I didn't know if it was covering something hard or soft. The piano player was singing an upbeat Sinatra tune, and a busboy brought us warm rolls in a linen-covered basket. I broke one in two. So how come you need to wear this cape and mask, Les? That's a good question. Lester sliced into a roll and buttered it. Our waiter showed up just then and asked if we'd picked out an appetizer. I thought he was doing a nice job trying to get the final bill as high as possible for himself, but we decided to skip the appetizer and ended up ordering 2 of the night's specials instead, the chicken Provençal for me, swordfish with lemon caper sauce for Lester. He started to hand the wine menu back unopened, but before the young waiter disappeared, I told him to bring us a decent Napa Valley Chardonnay.
What are you up to?
I couldn't help smiling. I ordered it for you. I know you want some. So what's the illegal thing you did a long time ago? He looked at me a second. I'm still stuck on your other question. Okay, answer that one. Lester smiled at me, all the tightness in his face gone, nothing but the gentleness now. The piano player was singing an old jazz tune. Les touched the tines of his salad fork and started to talk about his boyhood in a town called Chula Vista on the Mexican border, and I should have been taking in every word, but I was thinking of the Chardonnay I'd ordered. I was thinking how it really was true. I'd never had any problems with alcohol until I started doing lines, snorting those long white snakes straight to my head. Then the waiter was at our table with an ice bucket. Lester paused and tasted the sample splash in his glass. He said it was fine, but when the waiter started to pour, Lester touched his arm and told him thanks, but we'd prefer to serve ourselves. The waiter left, and Lester filled his own glass, glancing at me before he wedged the bottle back into the ice bucket. What was I rattling on about?
Chula Vista.
My brother Martin and I, we were the only Anglos in the whole school, and just about every day we'd get taunted into a fight with somebody about something.
That's why you plant evidence?
Planted. I only did it once. He tried to smile, but it wouldn't finish itself on his face.
What's wrong? Do you think I did a horrible thing?
No, I think you did a good thing, actually.
I'm sorry, Les.
Tell you the truth, the wine's distracting me. I'll send it back.
No.
I rested my fingers over his. See, whenever I think of my sobriety, I don't think of wine. I think of cocaine. That's what I'm proud of staying away from. My husband, my ex-husband, whatever you want to call him, he was a bad drinker, and I haven't ever said this before, but I think I just let him sweep me up into his recovery program, you know? Whenever I needed to go to RR, it wasn't because I wanted a glass of wine. It was because I had to do a mile of coke. Lester was giving me that long-eyed look again, squeezing my hand back as I spoke.
Don't you mean AA?
No, RR, rational recovery. Your higher power is your ability to reason. It's all a crock of shit, really, but I don't know. I let go of him and looked out the window. We were facing west now, and I was looking out across the northern edge of the city, over all the buildings and piers to the orange sweep of the Golden Gate Bridge, and the ocean on the other side of it, the sky a band of red and purple. The restaurant had gotten more crowded, and I could hear behind me the low din of people talking and laughing through their meals, the tink of silverware on porcelain, the piano player finishing the jazz number and going right into something else. But I kept my eyes on the ocean while the restaurant continued its slow turn away from it. Then I heard Lester pouring something into my wine glass, and I turned to see him holding the bottle of Chardonnay.
You're a grown woman, Kathy. Maybe you threw the baby out with the bathwater.
But what if the baby was a demon?
Then you toss it out for good and don't look back.
Do you ever look back, Les?
All the time, he smiled.
That's my problem, Kathy. I'm sentimental about my fuck-ups.
Me too.
I smiled and picked up my glass, felt the cool weight of it in my hand. He touched it with his, and I kept my eyes on him as I raised the wine to my lips and tasted what I hadn't even let myself smell in 3 years. For a second, I had the thought that there was still time to spit it out, but if there was an enemy voice in my head, it was the one that would keep this from me, the swallowing, the dry heat spreading out in my chest. It was such a familiar taste and feeling inside me, almost like it had never left, that I suddenly felt more like my true self than I had in I didn't know how long.
So far so good? Les said.
Yes. I sipped once more, then put my glass back down, holding the stem lightly with my fingers.
Tell me more about you, Les.
Our food came then. Lester topped off our glasses, and I knew, according to the rationally recovered, I should be looking at this whole dinner as the B-E-A-S-T, nothing more than a boozing opportunity with an enemy voice in my head that I had to now accuse of malice while my reasoning powers started giving me reminders of my self-worth, leading me to treasure my sobriety and then successfully abstain. But there was no enemy voice in my head, I told myself. If there was, it would already be ordering a second bottle, which I didn't feel the need for at all. So there was nothing to accuse of malice, and I didn't feel like accusing anyone of anything anyway, not tonight. I was even feeling all right about the Arab family living in my house, the kind-faced woman who'd wrapped my foot, the people who had agreed to sell back to the county. Between bites and sips, Lester told me about his mother and father divorcing when he was 12 and his brother was 9, how his father, who was a customs officer, used to visit once a week until he got another job in Texas, and the two boys only saw him twice a year when they had to go on a 15-hour bus trip to do it. He said his mother was a looker with long brown hair and high cheekbones, and this quiet way about her that drew men right in. She was a typist at a lumber company, and once word got out she was divorced, Lester and his brother were watching men come to the door for her almost every night. I sipped my wine. My face felt warm. I loved watching him as he talked. The way the candlelight showed the dips in his cheeks made his crooked mustache look as thick as straw, his eyes deep and dark. "That's why," I said. "What?" "You had to protect your mother, so now you protect the peace. You think it's that simple?" "Nope," I smiled. "But I wish it was. I wish everything were that simple." I looked out the window to see where we were, and my own candlelit reflection looked back. On the other side was night, and all the lights of San Francisco spread out below. I drank the rest of the wine from my glass, and I couldn't remember the last time I felt so free of all the shit that pulled at me like the gravity of two planets. I was feeling some of the wine, but not much. I'd eaten half of my baked potato and chicken. I looked back at Les, and I could see he'd been staring at me. "Let's go dancing, Lester." "What about your foot?" "Shit, I forgot about that," I laughed. We rode quietly together. The Bayshore Freeway was lit up with orange streetlights, and Lester drove with his warm hand on mine, and I was thinking about Nick, him and me driving west in the new Bonneville, driving all day and night. I took in Lester's dimly lit profile. Sometimes I think husbands and wives, maybe they're just meant to get each other farther down the road, you know? Almost like it doesn't really matter whether or not they stick around for the final act. Is that a sad way to look at it? Depends on your situation, I suppose. What's your situation, Les? You haven't breathed a word about it. Lester flicked on his indicator, glanced in the rearview mirror, then steered into the exit lane. I could feel myself sort of go still while I waited for him to speak. He took the off-ramp, pulled his hand from mine to downshift, and kept it there. "My situation is my wife thinks I'm working overnight patrol till tomorrow morning. I guess that's pretty presumptuous of me, isn't it? Is that really your situation?" Les didn't answer. We rode by the shopping center, the display windows partially lit, the dark parking lot empty. Les pulled up to my door at the Eureka Motor Lodge, and he turned off the headlights but kept the engine running. "I married my best friend, Kathy. That's my situation. We have a son and a daughter, but for 7 of the last 9 years, I haven't wanted to give her more than a hug or a peck on the cheek." The light from the walkway was catching the side of Lester's face, lighting up only one half of it and making his cheekbones stand out more, his mustache, and I thought I knew what he might look like as an old man. Handsome, sad, and quiet. "Do you still love her?" "Like a sister. I don't have one, but I feel like I do." "What about her?" "It's not the same for her." He was looking out the windshield at the door to my room. "I understand if you don't want me to spend the night, and I'm not telling you this to make you feel obligated, but I'm not going home anyway. I do need to think." I thought of Nick, the way his face looked the morning he left, like he was sure he was killing me by leaving. Lester almost had that same look now, and I started to feel mad about it. But then he turned to me as if I had just told him what I was thinking, and he said if it were only him and Carol, he'd be gone, but it wasn't. It was his kids, his daughter Bethany, his son Nate. "I'm sorry, Kathy, I don't mean to dump any of this at your feet."
He got out of the car, opened my door, and helped me out. The engine was still running. I wrapped my arms around his neck and kissed him. Turn the damn thing off and come inside. That night, we held each other under the covers, and he asked me question after question about myself, how I'd ended up in that small hillside house in Corona, what my life had been like until then, and I told him about growing up in Saugus with its shitty strip of neon car dealerships, Italian and Chinese restaurants and tanning parlors, shopping malls, my father's small linen delivery business, how, when I was little, I would ride with him on his Saturday morning runs delivering aprons and tablecloths to restaurants, drinking too many Shirley Temples along the way until I was giddy and my father smoked Garcia y Vegas while he drove and listened to ball games on the radio. And sometimes I'd feel sick, but I wouldn't tell him because he hardly ever spoke to me and I didn't want to spoil my chances. I snuggled in close and pulled my leg up over his. His skin smelled good, like the ground somehow. I didn't talk about my first husband, or Nick, and I didn't mention rehab again, or that it was my brother, Frank, who'd found me in my apartment. The white snake wriggled so deep inside me I was classified a suicide risk as soon as Frank and Jeannie admitted me. I didn't mention any of this. And Les seemed content for now to hear of me only as a young girl, though he got quiet after that, and I wasn't sure if it was because of the girl I'd told him about, or maybe his own daughter at home. I fell asleep with my cheek on his chest, and sometime during the night we woke up making love. The next day, Thursday, he went home to his family, and I spent the morning doing my laundry at the shopping center laundromat. I was still hopping on my good foot, but the other was feeling better, and after a lunch of cold Szechuan food in my room, I soaked both feet in the bath. By the middle of the afternoon, I worked up the courage to call Connie Walsh's office. Gary said again she was out, but that they were making progress on the house. His voice sounded different to me, not as businesslike. "What kind of progress, Gary?" "My boss will kill me, but, oh, what the hell? The county has admitted their mistake, Mrs. Lazaro. Evidently, they should have built a 34 Bis Cove Street all along, not Bis Grove. And apparently, they're willing to rescind the sale. By Saturday?" I stood up and danced across the carpet, completely forgetting my foot. Gary said he'd already told me more than Connie would appreciate, and I should really talk to her about all this. She still had to work things out with the new owner. Then he told me to call back sometime tomorrow. He knew for a fact she'd be in the office. "I could kiss you, Gary." "Goodness, no," he laughed and hung up. In the late afternoon, I cleaned my Thursday house, then drove to the pediatric office near San Bruno and went to work on that. I was working up a good sweat, and even limping along with the vacuum, I was staying at a fast pace. Lester and I planned for him to meet me at the Motor Lodge at 7:30, and I was stepping out of the shower when he came, telling him the good news as I dried off and dressed in the bathroom with the door a little open. He walked in and hugged me and said we should go out and celebrate, but I was tired from trying to stay off my sore foot all day, and when I told him this, he looked disappointed only a second or two before he left, then came back a half hour later with an avocado and black olive pizza, a pint of chocolate ice cream, and two bottles of Great Western champagne. We sat cross-legged on the bed and ate half the pizza, drinking the first bottle out of Eureka Motor Lodge plastic cups. We started to kiss, and Lester opened a package of condoms, but the bed was such a mess we made love on the floor near the bathroom, and I was halfway to being loaded, or maybe I already was. Behind my eyes were 100 bees, and I remember hearing something big go by out on the highway as Lester's body froze up, and he pushed into me one more time, let out a moan, and said into my ear, "I love you, Kathy." I wasn't ready to say that back. I laughed and pushed on his shoulders until he had no choice but to finish me off with his tongue. He did, and it didn't take me long at all. We drank the second bottle in the bath. Les sat back against the faucet, his black hair so wet his ears stuck out and his mustache dripped water,
I laughed and couldn't stop until he snapped me out of it by singing a Mexican song he'd learned as a boy. He sang it in Spanish, looking right at me, like he were trying to caress me with each beautiful foreign word. Then he paused to sip from the bottle of Great Western and recited the last verse to me in English, his small brown eyes a little bloodshot. Your love was lightning on the mountain. Your love was a river in the trees. Your love was sun upon the desert. Oh, but where is your smoke, your stream, your salt? Why are the coyotes silent? When will they call your name? Friday morning, we woke up hungover. The curtains were closed and the room was dark. Les sat naked at the edge of the bed, called the front desk for coffee, then took his watch from the bedstand and held it up in the pale light. My mouth was dry. My head ached above the ears. I should have been home 2 hours ago. He fell back on the mattress, and I scooted over and let his neck rest between my hip and ribs. He looked up at me. I'm sure she called the department, and I'm sure they asked her if I was feeling any better. He laughed, but it sounded like air forced out of a box. Do you really feel like laughing? I let my fingers rest in his hair. No, but things are finally in motion. Maybe I'm relieved in a way. There was a knock at the door. Lester answered it with a towel wrapped around his waist and took our coffee from a blonde teenage girl in baggy shorts. He handed her a 5 and told her to keep it. I put on my robe and used the bathroom before opening the drapes to a much too bright day, the sunshine reflecting off the cars in the parking lot, the white concrete beside the pool, and I sat at the table with the pint of chocolate ice cream from the mini fridge that overnight had melted. Lester and I took turns eating it with the tiny plastic spoons that had come with our coffee. But he didn't seem to be in the same room with me. He was looking at a spot on the table, and he would take a bite and shake his head, then sip his coffee and shake his head again. My eyes hurt, and I had to squint against all the light coming through the window. I got up and limped to the dresser and put on Nick's Ray-Bans. Lester was looking outside now, the hair at the back of his head sticking out like dog's ears. I was getting that off-the-ground feeling again, a little shaky about things between him and his wife coming to some sort of a head. I hadn't planned on that. I hadn't planned on anything. I suddenly wanted to be alone, alone in my father's house on the hill of Bisgrove Street. But then Lester turned and said I looked like a movie star standing there in that robe with those sunglasses, my hair all loose around the shoulders. He came over and kissed me. He tasted cool and sweet from the chocolate, and I hugged his bare back, wanting to say something, but I didn't know what. Lester said, "Tell you the truth, I feel more scared than relieved." "Me too." "You?" He stepped back to get a look at me, his hands on my shoulders. "Why?" I shrugged and took a breath. "I don't know. I feel lost. I just feel lost." I started to cry. He pulled me to him, turning slowly from side to side, kissing the top of my head. "You'll feel better once you get back into your house. Why don't you call your lawyer and ask her to tell you when you can rent the U-Haul?" I went to the bathroom and blew my nose. My mouth was dry, and I ran cold water in the sink and drank out of my hand again and again. Lester was dressed when I came out. He sat at the foot of the bed, pulling on his boots. Behind him, the sunlight through the window made him look like nothing but a shadow. Then the shadow sat up straight and looked at me. "I'm going to go get it over with, Kathy." "It?" "Telling her the truth. Stopping this masquerade ball I've been at for years." He stood. "It's strange, isn't it? You feel lost, but I feel found." "I do. I'm scared, but I feel found." On his way out the door, he turned back to me. "And you will too, Kathy, I promise. I'll move you back in myself." There's a hardness that happens, this dulling of everything that leaves you feeling minus instead of plus, hollow instead of solid.
cool instead of warm. Men always hear everything so wrong. I told Lester I felt lost, and he instantly thought it's because I'm living out of a suitcase. I didn't know this until he said that, but I guess I was expecting more from him, from his sad eyes and crooked mustache, his narrow shoulders and dark skin, the Mexican songs of his youth. Maybe I expected some kind of wisdom. But what I got was a distracted cop on his way home to maybe leave his wife, which left me feeling like some witch waiting for her brew to take effect miles away, and I wanted to get up and run as far as I could, but the inside of my head was too dry for my brain, and every time I moved it hurt. I lay down on the mattress and placed a pillow over my eyes, but then the coffee and ice cream seemed to spread out level behind my ribs, and I felt queasy and sat up. Why did we drink both bottles? But the question left me in a black cave. I picked up the phone and called Connie Walsh. I was going to ask her when I could start hauling my boxes and bags, and I guess a part of me wasn't surprised when she got on the phone and gave me the news in her flat lawyer's voice. I guess I was really expecting something like this, that the new owner was asking an impossible price, and not only would I not be moving back into my house this weekend, but she wasn't even sure it would happen any time soon. When then, Connie? I was looking at the two empty champagne bottles, one upside down in the wastebasket, the other on its side on the floor, the label hidden. Connie was saying something. I'm sorry, what? I said I think you should come down to my office, Kathy. Drive over today.
Saturday afternoon, I drive my Nadire to San Francisco to have her hair done by an Italian cuni who charges more than we should pay. His business is located in Ghirardelli Square amongst all the specialty shops, restaurants, cafes, and galleries whose doors are open to touring people from all over the world. In the morning, I trim the rear hedge bushes, and I am still dressed in the cagar clothes I before would wear only for the highway department. So I do not enter the Italian shop, knowing, as I do, the many Persian wives who make appointments with him. I sit upon a bench in one of the lower courtyards and watch the people pass by. Over our bungalow in Corona the sun was shining, but here in the city, in that area of large piers and wharfs they call North Beach, there is cool summer fog, a fine mist in the air, and many of the tourists look out of place in their short pants, sandals and shirts with no sleeves that show the undisciplined flesh of their bodies. Many of them pause in their shopping, asking one another to take their photograph as they stand beneath a shop sign or in the center of the courtyard, dozens of strangers walking by them. I hear the speech of Orientals, Greeks, Germans, and French. But the majority are the more large, more fed, pink-in-the-face Americans who carry their shopping bags, eating ice cream cones or drinking sweet sodas from cups as they walk past, their small, loud children leading them. I sit and I regard these cows, these radishes, and I again think to myself, these people do not deserve what they have. When I first came to these United States, I expected to see more of the caliber of men I met in my business dealings in Tehran, the disciplined gentlemen of the American military, the usually fit and well-dressed executives of the defense industry, their wives who were perfect hostesses in our most lavish homes. And of course, the films and television programs imported from here showed to us only successful people. They were all attractive to the eye. They dressed in the latest fashion. They drove new automobiles and were forever behaving like ladies and gentlemen, even when sinning against their God. But I was quite mistaken, and this became to me clear in only 1 week of driving my family up and down this West Coast. Yes, there is more wealth here than anywhere in the world. Every market has all items well stocked at all times. And there is Beverly Hills and more places like it. But so many of the people live in homes not much more colorful than airbase housing. Furthermore, those late nights I have driven back to the Pooldar apartment in Berkeley after working, I have seen in the windows the pale blue glow of at least one television in every home, and I am told that many family meals are eaten in front of that screen as well. And perhaps this explains the face of Americans, the eyes that never appear satisfied, at peace with their work or the day God has given them. These people have the eyes of very small children who are forever looking for their next source of distraction, entertainment, or a sweet taste in the mouth. And it is no longer to me a surprise that it is the recent immigrants who excel in this land, the Orientals, the Greeks, and yes, the Persians. We know rich opportunity when we see it. Nadi looks lovely as she exits the Kuni salon, her hair styled thick and black around her face. She pauses to put the checkbook into the green alligator skin bag she purchased in Bahrain not long after our flight from home. She wears a handsome green suit, the jacket buttoned at her waist that has grown too small these days, her hips and legs as well, too thin. Even from where I sit, I am able to see the lines around her mouth and between her eyes above her nose. My Nadire is so easily made nervous. Even this intimate dinner party for our daughter has tested her. And I have worried she may bring on one of her headaches that send her to bed for hours or days. But she is a beautiful woman, and I rise to meet her in the crowded courtyard. On the drive south to Corona, we stop at a florist shop in Daly City and purchase flowers Nadi chooses herself, so many they fill the large trunk space of the Buick Regal. I am, of course, concerned about the money we are spending for this affair. Nadire also insisted on some of the finest champagne, 3 bottles of Dom Perignon at well over $100 each. She even made telephone calls in her questionable English to the city for finding Persian musicians to play the Comanche and Dombak for us, and I was relieved she found no one at such short notice. But my Nadi appears quite contented. She sits beside me as I drive down the coast highway into Corona, and she hums an old American pop song I recognize about tying a yellow ribbon around a tree of oak. The sun has remained in Corona, and now, 2 hours before the arrival of Soraya, it shines on the green ocean, making it nearly too bright to view more than a second or two. We will have a beautiful sunset for our guests, Nadi John. Nadire nods her head only very briefly before telling to me again the final list of tasks to be completed in only the next hour. All the flowers must be arranged around the home and above on the roof porch, this is what she calls it, amongst the new outdoor furniture. Our Waterford flutes must be dusted and properly chilled in the freezer. You must set up the new tape player for music in the living room and make certain Ismail has put his room in order, bathed, and dressed in his French-made suit. I nod my head in reply, "Bale, bale, yes, yes." But there is no need for me to listen any longer, for I know the list very well. As I accelerate the Regal up Bisgrove Hill, I am thinking of my daughter Soraya, of her small, lovely face I will hold in my hands, and that is when I see a smile, speaking with a young woman on our grass under the sun. Her hair is straight and dark. She wears blue jeans and a white blouse, and there is the red Bonneville I have seen parked before against the woodland. I steer into the driveway, and she regards me directly. It is the woman who last week was sleeping in her automobile so early in the morning. Nadi touches my shoulder and says to me in Farsi, "That is the woman who hurt her foot, Masood." I extinguish the engine and tell to my wife, "Yes, she has come for a tool her Najjar boyfriend may have left behind. I've been expecting her." I step out of the car and walk over the cut grass, smiling and extending my hand to the woman, who hesitates a moment before taking it. "I am happy you came." I take her by the elbow lightly. "Please, this way, I will show you." I turn to my son and say low in Farsi, "Help your mother and tell her nothing. Later I will explain." Around the bungalow's corner, at the stairs to the widow's walk, the woman to me says, "I'm sorry, but I think you have me confused with someone else." "No, I am quite certain who you are. I'm Kathy Nicolo." She to me offers her hand, and I take it and release it quickly. The sun is upon us, and in this light her cosmetics stand out too much. She regards the ground. "I know my lawyer talked to you, but I thought we could just meet face to face, Mr. Baruni." "My name is Behrani, Colonel Behrani." The woman inhales deeply and looks upon the new widow's walk. My father left us this house. He left it to me and my brother. Esmail appears, carrying a large pot of chrysanthemums in his arms for the roof. I tell to him to please rest them on the ground and go. He leaves, and I say to this woman, I am sorry, miss, but you should be telling these things to the bureaucrats at the county tax office. They have made the mistake, not I.
Yes, but they've already admitted it. They said they'd give you your money back. Look, I know you put a new deck on. I'm sure they'll pay for that.
The woman pulls from her front pocket a package of cigarettes, lighting one with a cheap plastic lighter. She inhales deeply upon it, and I feel a hot impatience begin to move inside me. I hear the water running in the kitchen sink. I look at the window screen beneath the widow's stairs, but it is shadowed, and I cannot see my wife inside. I step forward, hoping the woman will follow, but she does not move. I am sorry, miss, but as far as I am concerned, I have nothing more to say to anyone. Why should I be penalized for their incompetence? Tell me that. You should sue them for enough money to buy 10 homes. I will even sell you this house for the right price. This is all I require. The rear door to the bungalow opens and shuts, and I take the woman's arm and begin walking her back over the grass.
I am sorry, I do not know where he left his hammers.
The woman begins to pull away, but I squeeze her arm more tightly, stopping in the center of the lawn under the sun. My family knows nothing of this, miss. There is nothing more to say of it.
Let go of me!
She pulls her arm free, her cigarette falling to the grass. She steps backward, an incredulous expression upon her face.
You can't just move in here and try and make money on this. That's not right.
I look once back at the bungalow, then cross my arms over my chest, feeling the push of my heart against them. The woman shouts at the unfairness of me, and she begins to use profanity, but I only shake my head at her patiently. If Nadire is watching from the window, she will quickly believe what I tell her, that the Najjar's girlfriend is crazy, divune, thinking I am someone I am not. The woman abruptly stops, as if she has suddenly realized the futility of all she is saying. She pulls her hair free of her face, and she regards me for a long moment. Then she turns and hobbles back across the street to her expensive sedan. I watch her turn the large car around, and as she drives down the hill, I step on her smoking cigarette, crushing it beneath my shoe.
I drove south on the Cabrillo Highway past the state beaches, smoking one cigarette after another. I'd forgotten my sunglasses back at the motel, and the sun off the water made me squint, but I kept seeing my brother, Frank, stomp that Middle Eastern prick into the ground. I wanted to drive fast, but the road was crowded with late afternoon beach traffic, so at Montara, I turned into the parking lot of a bike and surf shop, and I got out of the car and just leaned against it for a while, the last of the sun on me, my arms folded. 10 feet away, there was an empty phone booth. I wanted to call Frankie so much it made my stomach hurt, but I didn't move. For all I knew, Nick was back on the East Coast by now anyway, showing up at all the old places, and the word had gotten back to my family, and that was that. They'd be able to see with their own eyes who left who. But not this. Not to have Dad's house taken away from us while I lived in it. Yesterday, Connie Walsh told me in her office that the county had done their part and now it was up to the new owner to go along with the deal. But he wouldn't, and she said the only thing we could do was sue San Mateo County for the value of the house. My champagne hangover had gotten worse as the day went on. My head felt heavy and dry, and the panic I was starting to feel about all of this seemed bigger than me. You mean sue for damages and just go buy another one? Yes. You mean I can't legally get my house back? Not unless the owner gives it back to the county and they give it back to you. And I'm sorry, Kathy, but that no longer seems very likely. After the call, I canceled my afternoon job, closed the drapes in my motel room, and lay on my bed for a long time. The phone rang and it was Lester. He didn't sound like himself. His voice up but sad, too, like he couldn't quite believe his own words. He said he and his wife had a long talk, and they decided he should move out. You mentioned me? Yes, but Kathy?
I told her you're not the reason, and you aren't. Then he said he would call me today. Who knows? Maybe we'd rent the same U-Haul. I wanted to tell him then, tell him about my house, but there was a weight in his voice, a weight on a thread. I spent the night in front of the TV smoking, and this morning I sat in my motel room waiting for the phone to ring, waiting for Les to say he was coming to take me to breakfast, for Connie Walsh to say she'd been wrong, everything's set, go get your stuff out of storage. I just sat there, my lungs sore, thinking of the Arab woman wrapping my foot, the way she smiled at me like I was something to be pitied. I thought of the oriental carpets and the brass bed in my room, of the nomads and horses on the living room wall, the construction shit in the yard, and I dressed and applied some color to my face. I would just go there and explain things myself. And now my arm felt bruised from where that Arabic son of a bitch had squeezed it. A warm wind blew from the beach, smelling like seaweed and hot blacktop, and the sun was getting close to the horizon, and I had to put my hand over my eyes. The traffic had slowed even more, and I watched a jeep full of teenagers go by. They were tanned. The boys' heads were practically shaved, and their girlfriends' hair was all loose and rat-nested around their shoulders, though they were moving slow now, the road so wide open in front of them, 100 free choices to be someplace different. Les was already back at the motor lodge when I got there. His small station wagon was parked next to a Winnebago with Pennsylvania plates, and in the rear of his car were shirts on hangers draped over a suitcase. His uniform hung in dry cleaner's plastic on a window hook. My hopes went up, but I felt like I was dreading something, too, and I got out of the Bonneville and was stepping up under the awning to my door when he called my name behind me. He stood by a chair at the side of the pool wearing jeans and sneakers and that same striped shirt from that first time at Carl's Jr. At his feet was a tall Budweiser can. When I got close, he smiled. "Your limp's getting better." I stepped onto the white concrete around the pool. I'd thought I'd go over and hug him, but something was holding me back. We stood there and looked at each other. He seemed taller and thinner to me. Even without the cowboy boots, he seemed taller. "You still feel found?" Les looked at the pool water, his hands on his hips. "I feel so much I hardly feel anything at all." He looked back at me, his dark eyes half squinting. "What did you tell your kids?" "A lie. I told them a lie, Kathy." His lips came together in a flat line, and I went over to him and hugged him. He smelled like cotton and sweat. He hugged me back, and I felt something sort of jolt inside him. But when he spoke, his voice was okay. "I don't want to scare you off, Kathy. I really don't." My cheek was to his chest, and I could see the cars go by out on the Camino Real. He stepped back and looked at me. "I'm not, am I?" I could smell the beer on his breath, and I wanted one. "Oh, be quiet. I'm glad you're here." It was true. I was. I took his hand and led him across the parking lot and into my room. I squatted at the mini fridge and grabbed two cold Michelob cans, opening both, handing him one. I held mine up in a quick toast, then drank. It was cold and delicious, and I felt reckless, and I didn't care. I told him Connie Walsh's news, about my trip back to Bisgrove Street, of trying to have a human moment with the fucking Arab who hadn't even told his family the situation, who squeezed my arm so I'd stay quiet about it. "He put his hand on you?" "You could say that, I guess." I drank and looked at Lester, at the way he was shadowed with the sunlight behind him, only his mustache and eyes darker than the rest. "You remind me of a cowboy. How was it left?" Lester's voice was high and tight. I shrugged and drank some more. I never drank beer much, except on days like this. Hot days when you're tired and a little hungry, and there's an edge to everything. Les sat forward in his chair. "You mean if this guy doesn't want to sell your house back, he doesn't have to?" I nodded and let out a short laugh. "Look at us, Les. We're both homeless." Then I laughed harder, like maybe I didn't care about anything at all, and I couldn't stop.
That's not right. What is? I was smiling now. You're a complicated woman, aren't you? Nope. I think I'm a simple woman, actually. I'm just good at complicating things. I finished off my beer, but lowered it back to my lap like it wasn't quite empty yet. Do I complicate things? Les said. I looked at him. No. I mean, yeah. You do a little, but I'm glad you're here. I really am, Les. He stood and pulled me to my feet. He put his arms around me, locking his fingers together at my lower back. Spend the night with me. I don't want you paying for this room anymore, Les. You've got to think of yourself now, you know? He kissed me so I'd shut up, it seemed. I've got a fishing camp south of us. Another deputy's lending it to me till I know what I'm doing, or, you know, where I'm going. He kissed me again. Come help me sweep it out. Then we'll sit down and figure out how to get your house back. I know so many damn lawyers it isn't funny. I was starting to get that off-the-ground feeling again, like it didn't matter what I did because I wasn't connected to anything real in the first place. But I wanted to drive back to Bisgrove Hill with this man, to walk right into my house with tall Lester Burden in front of me, his uniform on, his gun in his belt, some sort of paper in his hand, kicking the Arab family right back to the sands of wherever the hell they came from. Are they good lawyers? Better than what you have now, I'm sure. I don't know why I thought his lawyers might know more than mine. I did, though. I kissed him, and he kissed me back, pushing me onto the bed, but I told him, no, let's wait. Let's wait and make it special. My hopes were up again, and on the way out of town, sitting in the passenger seat of his car with five cool Budweisers in my lap, I asked him to drive up Bisgrove Street. As we got near the top of the hill, Les drove slowly. In my driveway, behind the white Buick, was a green Mercedes-Benz, and in front of the lawn was a shining new Saab, or something like it. We had our windows rolled down, and there was laughing and some kind of tinny music, like Greek or Lebanese. Lester pulled his car over beside the woods. Jesus, he said. Look at them. And the last of the sunlight up on my roof, on the new deck, were seven or eight strangers, men in suits, the women dressed in reds, peach, and pink. One of them was big and had short hair and a gold necklace so wide I could see it clearly. They were sitting in white chaise lounges, holding champagne flutes, and there was a table up there under a huge white umbrella. Baruni was the only one standing, and he wore a black suit, one hand in his pocket. He held up his glass to a sitting couple I couldn't see too well because of the flower pots on the railing, and he was saying something, his back to the street. He's some kind of colonel, you know. He wanted me to call him Colonel. The hell with these people. Les turned the car around, meshing the gears once before he gave it gas. Baruni and a few others looked out at the street, but I only looked at him, his smile fading right away. Les sped up, and we drove down through the one-story shops and stores of Corona, then onto the Cabrillo Highway, the sky plum and green, the sun out of sight, already on its way to shine on Asia and the Middle East.
Nadira has lighted 10 candles throughout the room, and our family and guests have sat for many hours upon the floor at the Sofre, eating and drinking, talking and laughing. Now we lean back on large crimson cushions from Tabriz, sipping hot tea and sampling pistachios and mints as Gugush's music plays from the tape machine. Saraya is telling stories of our old life in Tehran when she was a young girl, of our driver Bahman, and how he would allow her and her playmates to sit in the rear of the limousine as he drove throughout the neighborhood and they pretended to drink tea and speak of palace affairs. Nadi has brought into the room our leather-bound photo albums, and I watch my daughter's new family as Saraya shows to them picture after picture. My son-in-law is a quiet, respectful young man. Dressed in a gray pinstripe suit, all the evening long he has stayed at Saraya's side, but he has not once touched her, which is proper. With his eyeglasses and very short hair, he appears older than his 30 years. Both his mother and sister are large women, though they have dressed very tastefully in the latest colorful fashions, and they are quite warm, laughing with ease at the smallest opportunity. The girl's husband I find more difficult to bear. He is young, with barely 25 or 26 years, and he owns a jewelry shop in San Francisco. His suit is elegant, but on 2 fingers of both hands he wears gold, diamond, and ruby rings. And throughout our dinner of chelo kebab, khoresh badam john, and ob gusht, whenever he reached for his Coca-Cola glass, his shirt cuff pulled back to reveal gold chain bracelets on both thin wrists. And when he addressed me, it was as Janob Sarhang, Honorable Colonel, but with a tone of such exaggerated respect I did not believe his sincerity. So now it is a relief he has gone into Ismail's bedroom with my son to play computer video games. But still, I cannot become fully relaxed. I watch Soraya's face in the candlelight. She has become such a lovely young woman, now wife. She wears a conservative white blouse with jacket and a skirt that matches, her legs folded like a lady's beneath her. Her black hair is held up on her head. Around her neck she wears the pearl necklace her mother and I gave her as a wedding gift, and her eyes are alive with flame, her teeth white, but her talk and laughter leave me unable to relax. As soon as she stepped out of her husband's automobile, she regarded the bungalow and her eyes lost something before she rushed to meet us on the grass. The Dom Perignon upon the widow's walk, the fresh flowers and new furniture, the view of the sea seemed to help relieve her of appearing from a lower station in life. But all the evening long she has been talking of our summer home in Chaluz, our home in the most fashionable section of the capital city, the parties at all the homes of all the high officials of Shahanshah Pahlavi. Our guests have listened politely, and Nadi, who has been a wonderful hostess all evening, has interrupted Soraya to ask her new mother-in-law questions of their family, their health. And now, of course, the photos have Soraya reminiscing all over again. Earlier, as Nadi was serving the tadik in Masfakhiar, my son-in-law asked me how I was enjoying retirement. Did I have any hobbies? I had anticipated this question even before our guests had arrived, and I had prepared myself to speak of my activity in the real estate markets. But at the time of the question, Soraya was telling her new mother and sister-in-law of the night our home received a telephone call from the Shah himself, and I felt such an embarrassment I was not able to tell of my buying and selling bungalows without appearing to apologize for the manner in which we find ourselves living at the moment. I told my daughter in a warm voice to please change the subject. Bihorim, let us eat. And now, as I sip Persian tea through the sugar cube beneath my teeth, I am anxious for them all to leave. Soraya is well, but not before I take her aside and scold her for all her grandstanding, not before I hold her to me and tell her not to worry. This little bungalow is only temporary. Your mother and I are expecting quite a profit. Please do not worry about us. And I am worried about my son. Nadi's list of chores was long and the time was short, so I was not able to speak with him about this American woman, Kathy Nicolo, before the evening began. Ismail is an honest boy, and he sometimes speaks before thinking. I imagine him sitting at his video game he is able to win with closed eyes, perhaps talking out of boredom to the young jeweler, telling to him of the crazy woman who visited today. Nadi and my daughter's mother-in-law talked now of our home country, how they missed the flowers of Isfahan, the mosques of Qom, how the price of saffron here is not to be believed. Soraya is leaning close to her husband as she smiles and shows him a girlhood photograph of herself, the candlelight reflecting in his eyeglasses. I excuse myself and go to Ismail's room. The only light comes from the computer screen, and they are both sitting at the monitor, their eyes and faces hard with concentration. My son is taller than the jeweler, I notice. I stand in the doorway and listen to the beep-beeps of the electronic game. I listen to the voices of women in the other room, Gugush singing one of our 3,000-year-old love songs on the Japanese tape machine, and suddenly I feel I am a Mar de Pierre, a very old man. Soon it will be Ismail's new wife we will invite to dinner. But where will Nadi and I be living then? Will we still be in this country? Tonight I am longing to be back in Chaluz, The Caspian Sea stretched out before us, Purat and his family alive again and visiting us in our home. Earlier this evening, when the sun was setting into the Pacific and we drank French champagne amongst flowers and family, toasting our health, I began to feel the old ways once again in my blood. But then there was the loud sound of an automobile engine, and I turned to see this woman, Kathy Nicolo, staring at me from the passenger seat, a man at the steering wheel, although I could not see him clearly before they drove away, and I was left feeling accused of a crime I did not commit. I feel quite tired and hope our guests will leave very soon. For days I have been looking forward to this dinner, to seeing my only daughter again. But like so many things in this life, it is never as you dream it. And it is clear to me my daughter does not respect me as she once did. Throughout the evening, in between all of her talking, I would sometimes catch her viewing me with a distant sadness, the fashion in which people regard the blind or very ill. And it is perhaps this more than anything else that leaves my arms and legs so heavy with fatigue. Because Soraya is right. How far it is we have fallen, if everything we have is invested in a small bungalow on a hill in California. Nadire laughs quite loudly at the sofre, but it is not a genuine laugh, and I want to sleep now. I want to sleep and dream of kings.
Last night we stopped at a grocery store in Half Moon Bay, Lester and I walking down the food aisles, under all that fluorescent light, stopping to pick out wheat thins, steaks, and coffee as quiet and relaxed as if we'd been living together for years. But I wasn't relaxed, and I don't think he was either. The trip to my house had pissed him off, and he talked about it as we left Corona and drove south through all the beach towns on Highway 1, the sky a bloody mess out over the water. He kept asking me who the hell those people thought they were. What were they celebrating with their pricey cars and clothes? Taking a woman's house? I kept quiet and we shared a beer while he drove. I teased him about a cop drinking and driving, and Lester seemed to calm down and told me how, up until a few years ago, it was legal in Texas to drink while you drove, as long as you weren't drunk. At the store, he acted cheerful again, asking me if I liked this or would I prefer that before he dropped it in our cart. But I still heard a drag in his voice, like he was holding something heavy in his arms. I was hungry and the beer had gone to my head and I didn't like it. I was tired of feeling like my feet weren't all the way on the ground, like the real me was waiting for me somewhere outside my body, and I made a vow I wouldn't drink anymore for the rest of the night. 5 or so miles south of Half Moon Bay, Lester turned off the coast highway, and we drove along what he said was the Purisima River. A dry bed of stones with a thin ribbon of water moving through the middle, making white caps over small boulders as it flowed west for the Pacific. There was a pale green light left in the sky, and I looked out my window at low fields of artichoke plant, then woods, and an occasional house or trailer. There were lights on inside, so I guess I expected electricity when we got to where we were going. I had turned on the radio on the highway, but now, maybe because of all the trees and the mountain I knew was somewhere ahead of us, not much was coming in, so Les turned it off. He was being very quiet, and I wanted him to talk more. We left the main road for a much more narrow one, the pavement worn to dirt in places. Then Les turned the car onto a trail of flat rocks and pine needles, the woods dense on both sides of us, and he drove slowly, and we rocked in and out of shallow ruts in the ground. A couple of times the bottom of the car grated against rock and Les said shit under his breath. When the trail got even more narrow and low pine branches started scraping the top of the roof, Lester stopped the car and we locked it and I followed him along a path as he carried 2 bags of groceries and I carried one. It was almost too dark to see without a flashlight and the air had gotten cooler and smelled like pine and dried eucalyptus. I could hear the Purisima River through the woods on my left. Then Lester walked up 3 wooden steps and onto a porch with me right